Welcome to episode 28 of Abbott and Costello Meet the Podcast. Today we'll be discussing Abbott and Costello Meet the Invisible Man. Most roses are red, most violets are blue, most podcasts have a host, and here's our guy, Nick Santa Maria.
I love your rhyme scheme.
It's not a scheme, it's a conspiracy.
Thank you, Groucho Marx. Well, coconuts is public domain at this point, so
exactly.
Feel free.
And if you're going to steal, steal from the best. That's what I always say.
Or the coconuts. sorry, I don't find it funny anymore. I used to find it funny when I was a kid. I don't find it funny. I find it interesting. You know, it's a 1929 early talkie. The Marx Brothers are, you know, as young as we're ever going to see them. But I don't find it funny. Yeah. So that's here nor there. Jerry, it's always a pleasure to see you.
And always a pleasure to be seen by you, my friend.
But, you know, and we're making all of our listeners jealous because they can't see you, you know?
It's which, you know, may not be a bad thing, actually.
Well, you know, I might go to the ICU and that would be a hospitable way to do it. Let's nurse that one. Okay, so we are talking about let's start with the thing. First of all, how you doing, Jer?
I'm doing very well, sir. I was fighting off a bit of a cold. Had the greatest thing in the world happen. I went into work on Thursdays, you know, just the dregs of a cold trying to hang on. And my supervisor said, you know, you don't come in tomorrow. Take the day. And I thought, take Friday into a full 4-day weekend? Yeah, I'll do that.
First, I'm going to stop and buy a box of tissues. Yeah. And then I'm going to go home and eat it.
Yeah. I felt a heck of a lot better after that. So
well,
there
that's
you go.
Great.
This is How are you doing?
That's great. What am I, sucking helium? That's great. Oh, boy. Anyway, so that's good to know that you're feeling better, that you've overcome the cold. Interesting stuff going on.
Okay.
Lately. Yeah, yeah. I'm supposedly cast in a new film, a new comedy called Marvin Maroney or Marvin Maroney Private Dick. That'll give you an idea of the level of
okay.
Comedy. No, it's supposed to be like a Farrelly Brothers type comedy, a Wayans Brothers kind of thing. And supposedly I'm a FBI chief, Tony Colombo. No offense, you know what I mean? My wife is crazy about you. You never know. You never know. So that's going on. And I wanted to talk to our listeners for just a moment, personally, from me to them. I was telling Jerry before we went on the air that I get this a lot. We love your podcast. We love the information and it's funny and this and that. But now I'm going to leave it there. There always seems to be a but. You people that listen, you have big buts, you know? But I mean in your sentences, not what you're sitting on at the
right.
Moment. But it's interesting. I first of all, this is the podcast. I can't mold it for everybody's personal tastes. Mm-hmm. If something offends you, turn it off. You know, if you can handle it, handle it. But I'm a comedian. I've been a comedian since I'm 15 years old. That's what, 20 years ago? And
give or take, yeah.
Give or take. But comedians don't like to be censored. We don't like to be told what to say, what not to say. I made a Trump joke at one point during the podcast, and I heard somebody, you know, take umbrage, you know? You shouldn't be doing that, blah, blah, blah. You know what? There's nothing I shouldn't be doing. That's all there is to it. And again, I love y'all. I really do. And I want you to listen and I want you to have fun and enjoy it. And I work hard. And so does Jerry. We work hard on this podcast to make it as good as it can possibly be. So let's leave it at that. And to tell you the truth, if you're not happy with it or, you know, if I say something that might offend you or whatever, feel free to let me know. Okay, you let me know. I'll apologize, you know, as they come. But otherwise, this is our podcast, and this is what we do. So enjoy it. And no, I'm not a Trump fan. I'm going to say it out loud. But I will temper my political statements. I was telling Jerry earlier that I seem to, over the past month, I've been talking about Rachel Zegler, the Snow White abortion from that horrible movie. And I've been making fun of her because she's been talking about politics. You know, she's 25 and she's talking about politics. And I made fun of her for it. And then I went ahead and did it. So I'm apologizing for that. And I'm going to watch it from now on. That's the one I'm going to watch. Okay. But otherwise, enjoy the podcast. It's a podcast. Have fun. Okay. So I got that out of the way. And we're here to talk about, I think, one of their better movies in general, not just in the 1950s, but one of their better movies in general. And it's a very different film. It's Abbott and Costello Meet the Invisible Man. Now, this is the, what, second horror movie where Abbott and Costello meet a horror star. The first one, of course, was the big three, you know, Frankenstein, Dracula, the monster, Dracula, and the Wolfman.
Yep.
I don't count Abbott and Costello Meet the Killer, because there really was no monster involved. Mm-hmm. But this one, we go back to 1933's The Invisible Man. But if you really want to go back, let's talk about H.G. Wells, who wrote the original Invisible Man. He was born Herbert George Wells. That's what H.G. stands for, Herbert George. I wonder how many people knew that. He was born in September 21st, 1866, in Bromley, Kent, England. He died August 13th, 1946. So he got to see Abbott and Costello, and he was 79 years old. His gifts, his occupations, he was a novelist, of course, a teacher, a historian, and a journalist. He went to the Royal College of Science in England. That was his alma mater. His genre was social science fiction, not just science fiction, social science fiction. He was making points with his science fiction, satirical points about the shape of the world. His best known works, I'm just going to rattle them off quickly: The World Set Free, The Outline of History, The Country of the Blind, The Red Room, The Time Machine, The Invisible Man, The War of the Worlds, The Island of Dr. Moreau, The First Men in the Moon, The Shape of Things to Come, and more. He was quite a remarkable man. And I know that Island of Dr. Moreau, he hated the first movie. Island of Lost Souls, it was called. Mm. He hated it. He felt they were exploiting the horror while ignoring the message, which was about animal rights, basically.
Yeah.
So yeah, I already love H.G. Wells. He was just wonderful. So he was the guy behind the seed of this idea. And speaking of which, we talked about Hugh Wedlock and Howard Snyder. Now, these were two Jack Benny writers on radio, two wonderful writers. They worked on In Society and Meet the Killer. And here they were putting together a straight movie about The Invisible Man. Now, The Invisible Man was made in 1933, but then there were sequels, like in 1940, The Invisible Man Returns, The Invisible Man's Revenge. Then there was one where he's a World War II soldier, and then there's The Invisible Woman. You know, so Universal used that invisible thing ad nauseum. This was supposed to be the next in the series, The Invisible Man Strikes Back, and it was going to be a straight Invisible Man horror movie, which I find interesting because in 1946, they pretty much released their last horror movie, and it wasn't even a horror movie. It was The She-Wolf of London. Mm. 1946, it starred June Lockhart and Don Porter. Biggies. Well, June became a biggie. And Don Porter became Gidget's father on TV. Mm-hmm. Everyone knows it's Gidget. La, da, 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 da. That may be my earliest TV memories. But anyway, so this was supposed to be a straight Invisible Man movie. But then Universal looked at it and said, you know what? This might be a good Abbott and Costello movie. So they handed it over to our pals, Robert Lees, Frederick Rinaldo, and John Grant. And they turned it into the movie we have now, which is pretty terrific.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the big change in this movie, I mean, this is Charlie Lamont is directing his third movie with the boys, got a bunch more ahead of him. But the new producer, Robert Arthur, finally left after Foreign Legion. He went to Warner Brothers. And, you know, he talked about working with Bud and Lou. He said, I never really socialized with them, never had them to the house, never went to their house, but we got along very well. He was a little tired of the, you know, the card games and the pies and Bobby Barber, you know, turning up everywhere. And he just wanted to get back to just straight movie making. But he said that Lou had a very serious side to him, and that the only conversations they would have would be after all the pie throwing and blah, blah, blah. Lou would come into his office and sit down and talk to him about the state of the world, about poverty, about juvenile delinquency, all of these serious things. And Robert Arthur was very appreciative of that. And he felt like, you know, that was their link together.
Yeah.
He enjoyed working with them, but it was time to move on. And he announced the next producer that was coming up. And this is an important one for a few reasons. This is Howard Christie. Now, Howard Christie was born in 1912 in Orinda, California. Never heard of it. He attended UC Berkeley, where he was a center for the Cal Bears football team. He was an All-American. He had planned to study medicine, but became interested in Hollywood after he played a small part in an anti-communist comedy movie called Fighting Youth, which I have to look up and see. After that, he decided to get into the filmmaking business. He got into the production side. He began as an assistant production manager at Universal. Then he transitioned to assistant director and then director. Ultimately, he became a producer, and he was that until he retired in 1970. He mostly produced westerns, comedies. He produced more than 40 films, including Against All Flags, Away All Boats, several Ma and Pa Kettle movies, several Abbott and Costello movies, including Abbott and Costello Meet the Invisible Man, Go to Mars, Meet the Mummy, and Meet the Keystone Cops. So Howard was very big in their later career. But he also, once he was done with Universal, in the late 50s, he became the vice president of the television division of Universal. Big doings. He was responsible for the production of a lot of westerns that came out, but especially, and I'm sure you're way ahead of me, Wagon Train, all 280 episodes. And he hired our boy, Lou, in 1958 for his wonderful dramatic performance in the Tobias Jones story. So yeah. That's Howard Christie, and I love him just for doing that. he retired in 1970 at the age of 58 and died in 1992. So yeah, that's Howard. And he was, that was a big change, you know? Speaking of big change, number one, this movie was really low budget. Now it doesn't look it. And
no.
You would think that with the special effects, right, Jerry?
Yeah.
It would be more, but it wasn't. It was like $670,000, which is like B movie, you know?
Wow.
Yeah. And it made almost three times that. So go figure. What's Universal doing? You know, it's like either go in or stay out.
Yeah.
But anyway, that was the budget. And Lou Costello, that boy of ours, he had a company called Cosman Productions, and he bought 30% of the movie. So not only did Bud and Lou split $150,000 and get 10% of the profits, Lou owned 30% of the movie. So there you go. The boys were making money hand over fist. So anyway, we'll get to the other people as we go, which is the way I like to do this. Bud is back to his derby and his cigar, you know?
Yes. He looks so good in a derby. I don't know what it is, but yes.
You know, we always thought that Bud was like the turned down fedora, you know, the gangster fedora. But he looks better with a derby. So Bud looked really good with that look. I think it should have been his look. You know, like Laurel and Hardy were famous for their derbies. Maybe Bud could have become famous for his derby. But anyway, we're getting ahead of ourselves. The movie begins, the Universal International logo, with that very dramatic, horrifying music, which isn't Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein.
Yes.
Thank you, Joe Gershenson. We get more Abbott and Costello caricatures, right? These aren't bad because it's animated. I like the way the Invisible Man disappears, you know?
Yes.
And you see his footprints along the way. These are really cute opening titles. I really like what they put the boys through, you know, when the director one, when it says Charlie Lamont, they're like tied up on a psychiatrist's couch. You know, it's like, what? So anyway, I love the way this movie begins with the close-up of the feet walking during a graduation exercise. And we see all the feet walking, you know, in rhythm to the sound of the music. And then we see a couple of clumsy feet they're tripping over themselves. And of course, we know who that is. That's our Lou. And the boys sit down. And this reminds me of Sons of the Desert, when Laurel and Hardy are late to the meeting and everybody watches them come in, you know, and it's very awkward. But Lou misses the chair when he sits down. It's the first big laugh of the movie. But this is what, this is where it goes over the top for me. This is where it's like brilliant. He sits down, he misses the chair, he disappears from the frame, he gets up, sits on the chair, and he's got an entirely different hat on. He's got a derby on. And he notices it and he jumps out of the picture and comes back and he's got his mortarboard, you know, graduation.
Yes.
Who thought of that? That is just
yes.
To me, it was so simple and so easy, but it was so such a surprise. I really enjoyed it. So anyway, the boys are graduating from a detective college. Lou is so, you know, he's crying. He's his alma mater, and they're singing the graduation song and all this. And he finally says, "How did I ever graduate?" And Bud says, "I slipped the guy $20." So he bought Lou's license. But here's another thing I really liked. The transition. When he hands Lou the diploma, Lou opens it up and you see a close-up of the diploma. And then all of a sudden, it's a completely different scene. It doesn't fade out, you know, it doesn't dissolve. It just cuts to the diploma, the same close-up, and you pull back. Now it's on the wall of their office and they're hanging it up. Yep. So it's kind of like, boom, it was very modern. That's what they do now, you know, quick cuts. So I thought that was very interesting, and I got to hand it to Charlie Lamont for that. That was really, really good.
And it also harkens back to Foreign Legion, a comment that you made on our last episode, the fact that they're in Brooklyn. We have to go to Algiers.
Yeah.
And then it cuts to them in Algiers. You know, it's like, no transition. No, boom, let's keep this moving. You know, let's just keep it going.
Yeah.
I got that same kind of feeling on that cut. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It was like, let's go. They're already in. We don't need anything else. You know, I watched a movie with a friend the other day, and we were laughing because in these movies, they seem to think it's important to have the car pull up to the curb, the guy get out of the car, walk to the door of the business he's going to, open the door, walk in, walk through the lobby into the, you know, it's like cut to the office. It's like Bud would be like, don't do that. So I just find it's very interesting. That was a different way of doing things. So anyway, our star monster walks in at this point. Bud and Lou are, you know, they're ready, they're open for business. And who should walk in but Tommy Nelson? Now, they don't know it's Tommy Nelson yet, but who is Tommy Nelson? Tommy Nelson is a boxer, and he's accused of killing his manager, and he's on the lam. He's hiding out. So he comes to Bud and Lou, the detective agency, because he wants them to help him find the guy who really did it. Arthur Franz plays our hero, our invisible boy, born in 1920 in Perth Amboy, New Jersey. I'll bet you that held some sway with Lou, New Jersey. And he was quite the war hero. During World War II, he served as a B-24 Liberator Navigator in the United States Air Force. He was shot down over Romania and incarcerated in a POW camp, from which he later escaped. I love this guy. I just love this guy. His Broadway credits were A Hope for a Harvest in 41, Little Darling in 42, The Moon Vine in 42, and finally in 1947, Command Decision, which was a biggie, a big hit. MGM even made a movie out of it with Clark Gable, of all people. He made his screen debut in a big-time movie called Jungle Patrol in 1948. Oh, yeah. And he did a lot of movies, Eight Iron Men, Invaders from Mars, The Unholy Wife, and my personal favorite, Monster on the Campus. I'm serious about this. When I was a kid, whenever this movie came on, I had to watch it. He plays a guy who turns into a monster on the campus.
Okay.
Yeah, there you go. The entire movie's in the title. Did a ton of television during the 50s and 60s. And his final film was That Championship Season in 1982. Died of emphysema in 2006 at the age of 86. So that's our invisible man. And it's so funny because they have the radio on. When he comes in, they're describing him. And Bud just doesn't get it. He just,
yes.
That's it. He just, wow, $5,000. Ah, that's a lot of money. And Lou knows right from the start. So here's part of the difference that Matthew Conium writes about in our book. Lou becomes the smarter one in the 1950s. Lou becomes somewhat intelligent and someone more plugged in than Bud, you know? And this is the perfect example. Bud is all over the place in this one. Watching it last night, it almost made me feel a little uncomfortable because he was such a double crosser. He was such a, you had to watch him, you know? Mm. And it wasn't little stuff. It was getting this guy arrested and sent to the chair, you know?
Yeah.
Why did Bud allow this stuff? I mean, did he have a choice, really? Who knows? But he comes off like a real jerk, you know? Every chance he gets, he wants to double cross Tommy Nelson and turn him in for the money. Whereas Lou is always saying, no, we can't. He's a nice guy. He needs our help. What? I just don't get it. That's a weird thing about Abbott and Costello. You know, Bud could be any other actor, basically, doing this kind of stuff. But I love when they're doing stuff together. When they do the money changing bit after Tommy leaves, it's going back to the boys, you know, back to the boys. And it's so funny. And what I realized during it, while they're doing it, Lou is looking at us the entire time.
Yes.
We're in on it with him, you know, and it's great. I love it. He sucks us right in.
I don't think Lou Costello ever acknowledged the fact that there is a fourth wall.
Right. Well, if there was, Universal wouldn't pay for it. So anyway, Tommy comes in and his girlfriend, who is played by, now her last name is spelled G-U-I-L-D. How would you pronounce that, Jerry?
Guild.
Guild, right?
Yeah.
It's pronounced Guild.
Of course it is.
Yeah. When she signed when she signed with 20th Century Fox early on, they tried to do a campaign saying Guild rhymes with wild. that was how they were going to push her. And boy, she's anything but wild.
No, no.
out of all their leading ladies, she is in her own movie. She has no relation to Bud and Lou. There's one little scene where they connect, but she's doing a different movie. She's doing the Invisible Man straight movie, you know, with her father, the scientist. It's really weird. So Nancy Gertrude Guild was born in 1925, a year younger than my dad. She was born in Los Angeles. Makes it handy for, you know, doing movies. You're already there. She appeared in Somewhere in the Night for 20th Century Fox, The Brasher de Bloom, Abbott and Costello Meet the Invisible Man. Isn't that weird? she never made it at 20th Century Fox. It didn't work. She eventually stopped acting. She did her stuff for Universal, basically. And then she turned up as a panelist on the Dumont Network's game show called Where Was I? Which sounds like a game you would play with drunks. You know? Where was I? That's kind of a good idea, I think. You know,
I like it.
Yeah, a game show strictly for drunks. So that was the 52-53 season. She appeared occasionally on television, briefly returned to movies in Otto Preminger's Such Good Friends in 1971. She passed away in 1999 at the age of 73. So yeah, I don't think she was dull. She's very dull, you know?
Yeah.
Didn't do anything for me in the RUGA sense. And like I say, she's in her own movie.
Well, and it's not that we ever noticed this in an Abbott and Costello movie especially, but to me, she just came across as very one-dimensional.
Yes, exactly. It's not well-written. Again, she reminds me of the girls in the straight Invisible Man movies.
Yeah.
There's always a woman trying to get him to talk sense. Costello.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this one's a little lame. I do like Arthur Franz, though. I think he's a good...
Yes.
You don't know if he's going to be dangerous or not. You know, he's good. So we have her, and then we see the office of her father, the scientist, who's trying to dissuade Tommy from using the invisibility potion because it's been known to drive the person mad. And that's what happens in all the movies, all the Invisible Man movies. Now, there's a scene with a guinea pig where the guinea pig is strapped down and he's given the invisibility thing, and then we watch it disappear. That's all from a previous movie. You know, I wonder if the guinea pig got paid again. I'm not sure.
But depends on his agent, I guess. I don't know.
Really? I mean, what kind of an agent would that be? You know, it's like, yeah, my guinea pig, he's in Palm Springs for the week. When he gets back, I'll give him the script. We'll let you know. So yeah, we find out about the invisibility. We find out that it drives a person mad, but Tommy takes it anyway.
Yep.
Okay. The funny thing is, Bud and Lou actually accompany him to the doctor's house. And this is, again, Bud. I'm sorry, but Bud, he locks Lou in the room with Tommy Nelson, who's supposedly a killer. And Bud knows it. And he locks the door behind him. And Lou's like, let me out. Let me out. What are you doing? And Bud's like, what are you worried about? I'm here. Whatever it is. Excuse. But again, it's like, he just goes to get the cops so he could get the money and blah, blah, blah. But in the meantime, Lou is watching Tommy Nelson disappear for the first time. Mm-hmm. And I love the teeth as he's laughing.
Yes.
His teeth. His head disappears. You just see his teeth. Now, the way this is all done is it's like green screen that we use now, or blue screen even, or sunscreen. But sorry, Jerry, I don't mean to burn you up. But but listen, son. But what am I saying? But what was I just talking about?
The process.
Yes, the process. Now, what they would do is he would have to be covered in black, like black felt. Mm-hmm. And it would cover his head. It would cover his body. And then they would shoot him using that and then shoot the scene again. Right. And you wouldn't see him because it would be against a black background.
Yeah.
So it was all done that way. It was all green screenish kind of stuff, but it works beautifully.
Yeah.
And I was surprised to see that it wasn't John Fulton who did the effects, because he did all the others. This was David Horsley. Uh-huh. And I forget who his partner's name was, but he was originally with the 1933 version. So they knew what they were doing.
Nice.
So, yeah, it's great. He starts taking off his clothes and he just completely disappears. Lou does a fall here. And I watched it closely. In fact, I rewound it and watched it again. And I saw the process. He has to fall backwards, right? Which is never easy.
Yeah.
What he did was he stepped back. He looked quickly at the lamp to his side. You know, there's like a little table. So that told him the table he was supposed to hit was right behind him. Mm-hmm. So you saw him set up the fall as he was doing it. Now, I don't think the normal person would say, oh, look, you're setting up the fall. but, you know, I'm in the business. Yeah. And so is Jerry. So we know, we see.
And, you know, one of the things that popped into my head, I've seen this film a number of times.
Yeah.
And it always comes into my head that first time where Tommy's taken off his clothes, he's totally invisible. Why is it that people who turn invisible never wear underwear?
I mean, it goes along with that question, you know, when does the Wolfman, after he changes, when does he put on that shirt and the shoes or whatever? You know, he's like, he gets dressed to go out and kill people. So, I mean, I don't know.
Yeah.
These are the questions that are left unanswered.
Anyway.
Yeah, but that would be interesting. You see him walking around in his boxers and, you know, a wife beater. It's funny, but you're right. I didn't even think about that.
Yeah.
Didn't enter my mind. Okay, so Lou watches this whole thing take place. They think he's nuts, and the cop is played by our friend William Frawley.
Yes.
Yeah, who would have been in Miracle on 34th Street with you. Jerry might get a role as Santa Claus in the musical version of Miracle on 34th Street, but we're waiting. Keep your fingers crossed, okay?
Yes.
That's it. That's all I'm going to say.
Okay.
But you would be great. You would be great, Jerry. So, William Frawley, born William Clement Frawley in 1887. Wow. In Burlington, Iowa. He attended Catholic school, sang in the choir. As he got older, he played small roles in local theater productions at the Burlington Opera House, performed in amateur shows, though his mother, who was very religious, Irish Catholic, really discouraged him. And he had to leave town in order to follow his dream because his mother would show up and yell. So he settled in Denver. He was hired as a singer at a cafe, teamed with a pianist named Franz Rath, not Rathbone. They removed the bone. The duo soon moved to San Francisco with their act, A Man, a Piano, and a Nut. He introduced popular songs, actually, as a young performer. My Mammy, before Jolson. My Melancholy Baby, another one. And most famously, Carolina in the Morning. Nothing could be finer than to be in Carolina. He introduced that song. Let's see. He also did those on an album in the 1950s. Frawley sings The Old Ones. And he has a really good vaudeville shouting singing style. It's a lot of fun. Started in Broadway, played in, I think we went through this in One Night in the Tropics, but he appeared on Broadway in The Front Page. No, 20th Century. Sorry, it was the other Ben Hecht, Charlie MacArthur thing. 20th Century, which I think is even better than The Front Page. And that started his career in Hollywood. He made movies like Out the Wazoo. He was with Paramount forever, had a bit of a drinking problem, which caused a lull in his movie work, and that's why he turned to television, and he became the beloved Fred Mertz on the I Love Lucy show, and eventually he played Bub on My Three Sons. And I saw an interview with, I believe it was Stanley Livingston, one of the kids, and he was talking about the difference between William Frawley and William Demarest, who replaced William Frawley as Uncle Charlie, and they didn't like William Demarest. William Demarest was cranky and he didn't have time for the kids and blah, blah, blah. And Frawley was their buddy. He played catch with them outside. He'd take them to baseball games. They hung out together. You know, so it was really interesting to learn that. So Frawley was a decent guy when he wasn't drinking. But anyway, one more fact about him that I want to mention. In 1928, he was fired from a Broadway show called That's My Baby for punching Clifton Webb in the nose. Okay. Well, that was his first experience with the web. can you imagine? Clifton Webb? He weighed like 10 pounds and, you know, and he was a dancer, you know, he was like a delicate dancer. So that was William Frawley. And he brings Lou to the police psychiatrist. Now, did you know that police stations had a psychiatrist on call?
I was not aware of that fact until I saw this movie.
And it must be real.
It must be, yeah.
You're right. It was on the internet. But the doctor is one of my favorites. His name is Paul Maxey, and he's a huge, enormous elephant of a man. Mm-hmm. And I say that with all due respect and love. His real name was Paul Regan Maxey, born in 1907 in Wheaton, Illinois. Wheaton. he was born in Wheaton, Illinois. He played a lot of roles in films from 1937. He played Victor Herbert in Till the Clouds Roll By. He was in many TV shows from the 1950s onward. He was Mayor John Peoples in the sitcom People's Choice from 1955 to 58. That was with Jackie Cooper. And remember what was the dog's name? The Basset Hound, Cleo.
Yes.
The one who always heard what she was thinking.
Yes.
That was a good show. And he was on M Squad and Wagon Train, The Lone Ranger, Dennis the Menace, The Untouchables, Perry Mason, Lassie. And he died in 1963 at the age of 56. I'm surprised he made it that long. He was huge. Yeah. He was a huge man. My favorite role, The Narrow Margin. He played the detective. And he's so big that he blocks the villains from getting through the hallway, the narrow hallway of the train. And it's very funny. But anyway, I love Paul Maxey. Also showed up in The Barry Boys. He plays Jolly Jack. He's a gambler. What's Lucky Losers, I think it was called. Mm. Anyway, I love The Barry Boys. So yeah, he's trying to hypnotize Lou. This scene is really funny, and there's some good dialogue between Paul Maxey and Lou. So let's hear some of that.
I know. You saw this man disappear into space.
That's right.
Do you only see things?
Only when my eyes are open.
And have you ever seen anyone disappear before?
Yes, sir. My brother.
Uh-huh. This may have been the start of this complex, seeing things. Tell me about it.
Well, my brother and I, we were walking down the street. All of a sudden, he disappeared.
Into thin air?
No, into a manhole.
Oh. How about voices? Do you ever hear strange voices coming out of the air?
Yes, sir.
Uh-huh. When does this happen?
When I get the wrong number on the telephone.
Suppose you go over there and lie down.
Why? Don't you believe me sitting here?
Would you get over there, please?
All right. Yeah, lie down.
Perhaps we can find out something from your subconscious mind.
Now, tell me, what's wrong with me?
Well, you see, would you get down there? Often the conscious mind will lie, but from the subconscious we get the truth. Do you know where the subconscious mind comes from?
The subway?
Now look into my eyes. You are going to sleep. You are going to sleep.
One.
Sleep.
Two.
Sleep.
Three, four, five, six, seven.
What are you doing?
I'm counting cows.
Cows?
I'm allergic to sheep.
Well, it turns out that every time another cop enters the room, Paul Maxey is hypnotizing him with a watch, a shiny watch, mm-hmm. but he hypnotizes himself and Lou is holding the watch. And every time someone new comes in, they become hypnotized by Lou. So by the time William Frawley comes back with Bud, there's six people hypnotized in the room, everybody but Lou. And it's very funny. That's good stuff. That's really good stuff. Okay. They decide that they have to infiltrate Stillman's gym. They have to go and set up the fact that Lou is a boxer and he wants to challenge Sheldon Leonard's boy, Rocky Hanlon.
Yep.
And Rocky's he's dirty pool. He's in on all the setups and stuff. And Sheldon Leonard is the one who killed Tommy Nelson's manager because he wouldn't play ball. He wouldn't lay down. It's a gangster story. You know, it's basically a gangster story.
Yeah.
And Sheldon Leonard being the main gangster, which is as it should be. And he has a little assistant by the name of Sneaky. That's real thinking. You know, Sneaky. What do we call it? Sneaky. What, one of the dwarves?
Yes.
Come over or what? Sneaky. Anyway, that's played by the great Bobby Barber.
And this has got to be the biggest role that Bobby Barber has ever had in any of these movies up to date.
And it's wonderful to see him do more stuff, you know?
Yes.
He's got dialogue. He gets things going, you know, when they need to get going. He's sneaky. He's really sneaky. And he's got that pencil-thin mustache and stuff, mm-hmm. and he wears fedoras. I bet he enjoyed doing it. He must have really enjoyed it. So Sheldon Leonard, born Sheldon Leonard Burchard in New York City in 1907, the same as Paul Maxey. He went to Syracuse University. He was an actor, producer, director, writer, one of the biggest producers on television, often teamed with Danny Thomas, responsible for the Andy Griffith Show, for crying out loud, Make Room for Daddy, I Spy, which was groundbreaking. Just a wonderful, wonderful creative guy. Passed away in 1997 at the age of 89 in Beverly Hills. So he is our main villain, our main gangster. And Lou makes quite an impression at the gym by working the bag. And I don't mean Nancy Guild. I mean working the punching bag. And it's one of my favorite scenes in the movie. And it's one of Lou's funniest scenes ever. And that's not hyperbole. I mean it.
Yep.
The stuff he improvises during this is just gold. It's gold, Jerry. Gold.
It is. It really is.
It really is. What's happening is, Tommy is invisible, of course, and Lou gets up to work the bag, and he's not hitting it at all. Tommy's doing all the work, but it looks like Lou is doing it, and it's fantastic. I mean, it's amazing, all the things he's doing. He's doing it with his elbows. He's doing it with his fists. He's doing it with his head. When he starts blowing on it, it's hilarious, and he does it so many different ways that it's just such an entertaining scene. Just when Rocky Hanlon is about to pose for the reporters, they notice Lou and they all leave him. And they leave him alone posing. And he gets mad. And he goes over and he challenges little Lou. I mean, Lou comes up to his, you know, his breasts. And he goes to punch Lou. And of course, Tommy Nelson is there and knocks him out. So everybody thinks that Lou knocked out the champ, Rocky Hanlon. It's such a good setup.
Yes,
so
it is.
Right away, Bud steps in and he's like, why don't you set up a match with my boy? You know, what are you afraid to go in with him? Blah, blah, blah. They shame him into doing a bout with Lou, a championship bout. They call him Louie the Looper. And nobody notices that he's not even swinging. He's so fast, you know, but it's all Tommy Nelson, which leads us to the bubble room, the nightclub. Mm-hmm. This is their last chance, the gangsters, to get Lou to do what they want him to do. So what they do is, and here we go, and I'm going to embarrass myself. I'm in love with Adele Jurgens. You know, if I watch her and I think to myself, yes, that's a woman. That is a woman. And she's not a good woman. She's a bad woman. Yep. And that's appealing. She's that tall, leggy blonde. Her lips are a little too small for her face, and they tend to lean to the side, which makes her look like a dame. You know what I mean?
Okay, yeah.
The dialogue comes out of the side of her mouth, you know? So she's a real dame, and she couldn't play anything else, basically.
Yeah.
And that's fine with me. Her real name was Adele Louisa Jurgens, or Jurgensen. They're not sure, actually. She was born in 1917, are you ready? In Brooklyn, New York. In the late 30s, she was named Miss World's Fairest at the 1939 World's Fair, where Bud and Lou were working with Gypsy Rose Lee in a version of The Streets of Paris. So I wonder if they came across each other at that point. She worked as a model and a chorus girl. She was an understudy to Gypsy Rose Lee in a Broadway show called Star and Garter in 1942. She landed a movie contract with Columbia Studios in 1944, dyed her brown hair blonde, and she was usually cast as a floozy or burlesque dancer. She was in Down to Earth with Rita Hayworth, The Dark Past with William Holden, Armored Car Robbery, which is just fantastic. She plays Marilyn Monroe's mother in a favorite of mine, a B-movie called Ladies of the Chorus. Mm-hmm. And she was only 9 years older than Marilyn at the time. So it must have been a tough delivery. She played a gun moll in Try and Get Me in 1950 and Meet the Invisible Man in 1951. She was in a big MGM movie called The Cobweb in 1955, directed by Vincent Minnelli, starring Richard Widmark and Lauren Bacall. And in the 1950s, she had a radio show with her husband, Glenn Langdon, who was the amazing colossal man. You want to talk about B-movies. They married in the late 40s and stayed married until he passed away.
Nice.
Isn't that great? They had one child together. And they met while filming Treasure of Monte Cristo in 1949. So, yeah, they had a radio show called Stand By for Crime. And she played a character, are you ready? Glamour Puss Carol Curtis. Okay. And Glenn Langdon played Chuck Morgan. I guess he was a detective. And anyway, she passed away from pneumonia in 2002 in Camarillo, California, 4 days shy of her 85th birthday. Now, interestingly, she's in Firemen Save My Child, which was supposed to be an Abbott and Costello movie, but wasn't. And she's in that. And she's in three of my favorite Bowery Boys movies. One is the best one they ever made. First was Blonde Dynamite. In 1950. Then later in 1950, the best Bowery Boys movie ever, Blues Busters. That's the one where Satch gets a Bing Crosby-type singing voice. Absolutely wonderful. I think I watch it like six times a year. And she made one towards the end where Stanley Clements replaced Leo Gorcy in Fighting Trouble, which was a good late in the game one. So she had quite a career. And she's just, hubba hubba. So she has to seduce Lou. Now, interestingly, and I bet, Jerry, I would bet any amount of money that you thought the same thing I did when she sat down at the table with them at the nightclub.
Yeah.
And Bud kept trying to ingratiate himself.
May I join you?
Sure. Sit here, Miss Marsden.
Move over. I hope you don't get the wrong impression of me, but I have two good reasons for wanting to meet you. The first one is, When I read what Louis the Looper did to Rocky Hanlon, I said to myself, there's a man.
That's the first time anybody ever said that about me. And the second reason?
I'm a woman.
That's even better than the first one. How about a little drink?
No, thank you. Not here. I like privacy. There's nothing like wearing something comfortable and turning the lights down low and having a nice cool drink with a nice warm person.
Yeah, but my place at the Carlton Towers is overcrowded.
The Carlton Towers? Now, isn't that a coincidence or fate or something? I live at the Carlton Towers, too.
Hey, that's great. I live there, too.
I hope you like your room. I'll be home all evening.
Boots. Ah, shut up. You sound like Gunga Din.
But yep. It's right out of Abbott Costello Meet Frankenstein. You know?
Yes.
They're
yes.
going after Lou and he can't get arrested. So it's very, very, I found it very interesting. So anyway, she tries to seduce Lou. In the meantime, they're doing all this great stuff at the table. Lou orders spaghetti and Tommy Nelson is invisible. He's sitting in between the two of them and he takes the spaghetti and the two of them are doing Lady and the Tramp, you know,
yes.
They suck the spaghetti in. Luckily before they kiss, Lou sucks it in before Tommy gets a chance. And then there's Sid Sailor, who is so funny as the waiter, who can't believe what he's seeing or not seeing. And at one point, Tommy picks up a stalk of celery. And the waiter turns around and sees it floating in midair. And Lou puts his finger under it immediately, like he's balancing it. Like he's telling him, I'm working on my juggling act, you know. It's very funny. So anyway, she gets Lou to come to her apartment. And Bud devises a scheme where he's going to bring her a pot of flowers. Not a bouquet, but a pot.
Yes.
And inside the flowers is a recording machine. With a little record player, you know, the whole thing. A little, you know, hard to believe, but still. He goes in and she tries to seduce him. She gets into her nightgown and, you know, and Nick is getting a little overheated. And you guys must think I'm sick.
And well, no. I'm sorry. No? You're not the only one. You're not okay. the only
I'm
one.
So happy
don't
to
worry.
Because she is just sexy. So anyway, she's seducing Lou. He's got the record. Finally, she leaves the room for a second. He takes the record and he hears her coming back and he tries to put it in this pocket and this pocket. And finally, he puts it down his pants, down where his rear end is. And she sits him down and you hear... So much for the record. So, yeah, of course, Bud is like, did you get the record? And he goes, yeah, I got it. And he pours the pieces out in front of him. What is it that he squirts Bud with? He squirts Bud in the face with some water. And I can't remember.
When Lou goes in, when he initially goes into her apartment,
yeah.
Bud's out in the hall trying to hide in the hall.
Oh, and he looks
and
through
as
the
soon
keyhole.
As he goes in, Bud peeks through the keyhole and gets squirted in the face.
And yeah. With Lou's water gun.
Yes, then you see Lou in the apartment with the water gun.
I'm just a little squirt. That was cute.
Yeah.
So anyway, she's trying to seduce him. She wants him to lay down in the fifth round.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's the thing. That's what they're settling right there. So Bud and Tommy are still at the restaurant at this point, and Bud gets to do something that I love. The waiter hears Tommy speaking almost poetically. And when Bud sees that the waiter notices, he starts doing this.
Sure, I'm drunk. Drunk with the power of invisibility. I am the ruler of an invisible empire. My loyal subjects I will reward. My enemies I will destroy. To be or not to be. Alas, poor Yorick. A horse. My kingdom for a horse.
Put that down, pour us a drink.
You heard me, pour a drink.
Okay, and the bartender, by the way, I just want to mention, his name is Harold Goodwin. Mm-hmm. And he'd been in movies from the silent days. He was Buster Keaton's, one of his best friends. Oh. And he played the villain in The College with Buster and in The Cameraman. with Buster, and he did a bunch of the educational shorts in the 1930s with him, and I actually owned his makeup box. His real makeup box from his silent days, complete with makeup and brushes and everything else. Somebody bought it at a yard sale and gave it to me. I gave it to the Buster Keaton Society, the damn finos, because I think that's where it belongs.
Nice. Very nice. Yeah.
So that's Harold Goodwin. He pops up in a lot of different places, worked constantly. One of the things I love about the end of this scene is that Lou gets into it with one of the patrons at the bar. And at one point, he's knocked out. So Bud grabs his arms to lift him while Tommy grabs his legs. But you can't see Tommy. Bud is lifting the whole package. It's a very funny sight. It's very interesting. Bud suddenly becomes, Superman. So anyway, let's get to the fight. There are probably three great comic fights in movie history.
Okay.
The greatest to me is City Lights, Chaplin and City Lights. There's
no argument there.
Really, no funnier boxing scene.
Yep.
The other one is this one. I have to say, it's number two. And number three is Everybody Else. I mean, Jerry Lewis does a good one when they're in the Navy.
Sailor Beware?
Sailor Beware. He does a funny boxing scene in that. And Lou does a funny boxing scene in Buck Privates.
Oh, yes.
he gets punched and the heart turns around and it's on his butt.
My favorite from that one still is with Nat Pendleton as the referee. And Lou goes down and Nat goes...
2, 4, 6, 8, 10. What happened to 1, 3, 5, 7, and 9?
I don't like their numbers. They're odd.
Put them in. I like them.
Get them. That's a great. So Lou, who actually was a boxer in real life and actually a lifelong boxing fanatic, he knew all the boxers. He would socialize with them, and he was quite a good boxer himself as a young man. As Lou King, had quite a record. And he broke it in Adele Juergens' apartment. How's that for a segue? So here's why this scene is so beautiful and so wonderful and so hilariously funny. Lou is in the ring with Rocky Hanlon. Bud is in his corner, egging him on. And Tommy Nelson is in the ring with Lou. So again, Tommy's doing all the punching and all the hitting, and Lou is doing his best to, mimic it. At one point, Tommy's saying in his ear, right cross, left jab, okay, uppercut. And he does everything he does, but Tommy's doing all the punching.
Yeah.
And it's driving, what's his name, crazy. Rocky Hanlon is like, I'm hearing two voices out there. What is that? But the fact that Lou is not doing anything. He's not doing any of the punching. He's just sort of moving around, and he's brilliant at it. It's physically one of his best scenes.
Yes.
And it's just wonderful. My favorite part of it is when Tommy accidentally gets knocked out and everybody keeps tripping on him. First Lou trips on him, then Rocky trips on him, then the ref trips on him. It's so funny. I can't praise this scene enough. It really is. It's worth the price of admission, this boxing scene. Sheldon Leonard is really getting overheated because he's not listening to him. He's supposed to go out in five. They're not going to do it. Whatever. So Lou wins the fight. Actually, Tommy wins the fight.
Yeah.
And it's a championship bout. It's a middleweight championship bout. So Lou is the new champion. And they know that they're going to kill Bud. Bud is the manager. Mm-hmm. And that's what Sheldon Leonard did to Tommy Nelson's manager. So they go to the dressing room. And Tommy, again, is it that he's knocked out or he's away? I think he's away. He's doing something else.
Yeah.
So Bud and Lou are alone in the dressing room when Sheldon Leonard shows up with his gun and his henchmen. Now, here's this I find very interesting, and it's something I really, really like. Bud and Lou are handy with their fists.
Yes!
During this scene... You had the whole thing where Sheldon Leonard sees Tommy Nelson in the steam. A bullet hits the steam pipe, and you see him in the steam, his outline. So Sheldon knows to shoot him, and does. And not before, I think it's Bud, turns around.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
And knocks Sheldon Leonard out. He just punches one punch. Boom, he's down. I believe it. I'm sorry. This is all the pent-up rage he had. you know, slapping Lou and everybody else in his path, he lets go, and Sheldon is on the floor. He's out. And Lou is taking care of the henchmen.
Yep.
I mean, he's really punching the hell out of him. And boom, he's down. So they're more concerned about Tommy at this point. I think that's what motivated this sudden, you know, violence. So Tommy's, you know, he's got a bullet in him. And the next scene is at the doctor's place, the professor, and Tommy is on a bed, and Lou is on the other bed, and they're doing a blood transfusion. That's what he needs. And I mean, there's a little bit of dialogue here that Bud says to Lou.
It's lucky you had the same type of blood as Tommy. Why can't you be lucky sometime?
When I was a kid, and I don't know if anyone feels this way, but whenever I was watching a movie featuring the Invisible Man, you waited for the end to see the transition back. You know, so you would see veins, and you'd see a skull, and you'd see this. And it was great. I loved it. And I love it here, too. That, you know, it's what you wait for, basically. So Lou sees that he's there, and suddenly we realize that Lou is disappearing. And the doctor sort of good-naturedly says, yes, a little bit of Tommy's blood got into his. It won't last long. Now, this is a little bit of a controversial scene, I've found. I'm hearing from people, you know.
Really?
Yeah, the people that listen to the podcast have told me about this scene, that it really troubled them, especially when they were kids. Lou is naked, of course, and he's walking around invisible. And he and Bud get into an elevator at one point, and it's filled with nurses. And the door opens, and they're all hitting Bud because Lou probably pinched them all, you know. But very funny. But anyway, Lou sees that he's coming back into vision, and he's naked. So he grabs a towel and turns it into sort of like a diaper. It's really weird. It's like a triangular diaper. And he looks down, and his feet reappeared, but going in the wrong direction. So he's facing us while his feet are going the other way. And this bothered people, because then when he starts to walk, he's walking backwards while facing us. And he goes through a glass door, you know, which of course has his outline in it. And that's the end of the movie. So Lou Francis, his name is Lou Francis, which is his real first and middle name.
Yeah.
And Bud Alexander, William Alexander Abbott, he has to work with a guy who has feet facing the wrong way. So, you know, he's going to have to turn his gumshoes around, I suppose.
You know, I had mentioned to you, Nick, before we started recording, that my wife actually watched this one with me. She enjoys Abbott and Costello in small doses.
Right.
You know, that kind of a thing.
She has a smaller television.
Well, there you are. And she came in, I was watching this, she came in about 5-10 minutes into it and stayed for the rest of it, enjoyed it mm-hmm. for the most part. But she mentioned at the very end, and I have to agree with her in this one, not a great closing gag for this movie.
Mm-hmm.
The movie is really good.
Yes, it is.
And this feet backwards thing, it doesn't really
work. You know
really
what it work. Is, Gary, you know what it is.
What is it?
I'm going to disagree with you, because I always liked the ending. I always thought it was really bizarre and funny.
But yeah, yes.
It's a Laurel and Hardy ending.
Yes.
It's one of Stan's freak endings where, you know, they're either stretched or their legs are tied around their throats or they're facing the wrong way or whatever it is.
Or my favorite one where they're skinned alive and they're just skeletons with their heads on them. Yes.
In the Bullfighters. And that's one that disturbs a lot of people, Jerry.
Oh, yeah.
I hear it from a lot of people. And I think it's hilarious. I love it. But anyway, I'm bizarre that way. But yeah, this one, it bothers people. It bothers mm-hmm. people. But it is a Laurel and Hardy ending. You know,
yeah.
It's a freakish ending to a very, very strong movie, a very, very strong comedy. Now, there's really very little wordplay, very little of what they're famous for.
Well, yeah, there's just the one money-changing mm-hmm. physical bit, and that's really it. Yeah,
that's it. Everything else is based in the situations, the set pieces, the slapstick physical pieces, mm-hmm. and it all works. It all works. Just very quickly, I have to mention that they are very, Lou especially, is very low-key in this one, almost realistic acting in this one. But we have to remember where they are at this point, okay? Abbott and Costello were never busier, all right? They did their first Colgate Comedy Hour at this point, and they had 17 more to go. They filmed their first season of their filmed television show, 26 episodes. This is all this year. Making movies on top of it, their radio show, their live appearances. I mean, I can go on. They were so busy at this point. And it makes you realize they've been a team for 15 years now. And they had about, what, 5 more years to go, basically?
Yeah, roughly.
Five or 6 more years. And it's funny how in those 5 or 6 more years, it dwindled to nothing, to almost nothing. They had to go to Australia, basically, to work, you know, because they weren't making movies anymore. Universal, they didn't sign with Universal again. So they were, you know, they were ready to break up at that point. But even before that, I mean, this is a busy, busy, busy time for them. Again, I'm surprised Lou kept up this pace with his illness and everything.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just waiting to hear that he's got to go to bed again, you know, poor guy. And Buddy Boy, you know, this next one, he's much more prominent and he's much more Abbott from Abbott and Costello, which I love. And it's a fun little movie. I've got my things about it, but we'll talk about it next time. In the meantime, Jerry, I know I say it every episode, but I really, this is the highlight of my 2 weeks and I enjoy it so much. And I hope the audience enjoys it as much as we do.
That's my wish and desire as well. Cause you know, I'll finish these sessions always thinking it should be illegal to have this much fun. Really? It should.
I agree with you. I totally agree with you. And I'm going to repeat, some of you have subscribed to the channel. If you're listening on YouTube, I'm going to ask you again, please, the amount of people that are listening compared to the people that are subscribing or even liking is totally disproportionate. And again, I'm not threatening. I don't want to sound like I'm threatening, but unless we get to a certain point, there's really, I don't know what to say. You know, I don't want to stop doing this. I love doing it. And people have gotten in touch with me. Please don't stop. Please. We enjoy it. Well, please subscribe. You have to subscribe or, you know, I don't know what's going to happen. So that's that. And Jerry, I want to wish you a wonderful week ahead and good luck with your, did you do the 1X already?
Not yet. That'll be second weekend of June, those go up. So yeah, we're in the midst of rehearsing right now.
Good. Oh no, I'm excited to hear how it turns out, how everything turns out.
Thank you.
And in the meantime, just all the best to you, Jer. Thank you again for everything.
And to you as well. Looking forward to hearing more about this possible film that you're working on.
Oh boy. Keep a good thought. Okay.
Yep. 'Cause,
you know, you get offered roles, but you know, until you got your name on that contract, you don't accept it. So that's that. And thank you everyone for listening. Again, I apologize if I made any off-putting political remarks, and that is a thing of the past from here on in. But if I do have opinions about certain things and I want to talk about them, I'm going to talk about them. So anyway, take care, everybody. We love you and keep listening. Okay. Take care.